Okay, we should actually start. I'm a great believer in starting on time for this kind of thing. According to my clock, we have half a minute. No, according to the computer, we're starting. Okay. Jay is traveling to New York today in honor of President's Day to see his kids. Maxine is traveling somewhere, so we don't have a host. I'm the host. And therefore, I'm in charge of all technological problems. It's not a good thing. We're going to start. Well, first we'll start. Pardon me. I'll talk for a few minutes, and then I'll put up texts. Some of them I sent out yesterday, and I'm sure that Jay and or Maxine put them up for you if you want to keep them. But the texts we need are going to be on the screen in just a moment. So I want to remind you what we're doing here. Also to apologize. This was meant to be a three-session course last week, this week, and next week. But because of a scheduling mistake, I have to be teaching in Jerusalem next week, and it's a very long schlep. I will not get home in time to teach a 6 p.m., well, 11 a.m. class in North America. So this series will be two sessions, not three, and I apologize for that, which means that today I'll be dealing with two texts, two central texts, and not just with the one I originally planned to talk to you about. Okay. We are attempting to show you that one can learn from three core texts, passages in Rambam's Mishneh Torah, that he actually did believe that all human beings are created in the image of God, that there is no ontological, metaphysical, whatever difference among human beings. All human beings are essentially the same. That's not to say that he doesn't recognize the importance of the Jewish people and, of course, of the Torah, and not to say he denies the notion of Am Nivchar, the chosen people. The whole question is, what does that mean? And what I started to tell you last week is that some people who see the claim that the Jews are the chosen people as a reflection of the fact that only the Jews could have been chosen by God. There was something unique about the Jews as such that made it possible for them to receive the Torah and to become God's chosen people. That could not have happened to any other nation. Rambam, I'm convinced, and I'm fairly certain I'm right about this, held that the fact that the Jews are the chosen people is a reflection of the fact that we, the Jews, to the extent that it's us, are descended from Abraham, and that it was Abraham who chose God. And in reaction to that, God promised Abraham to take special interest in his descendants. But that in effect, if the first person to rediscover God after the human race had deteriorated into idolatry had been, say, a Navajo shaman, then the Navajos would be the God's chosen people, and Nevada would be the promised land, etc. Of course, Rambam doesn't think that that's what happened. What happened is that Abraham chose God. But that's the important point. Abraham chose God. It's not that God chose Abraham. And we can't go into that today, but that's a fundamental aspect of Rambam's universalism. In effect, anybody could have been a Jew, and in effect, anybody can become a Jew within the guidelines of Halakha. And in consequence of all the Jewish thinkers of the Middle Ages, he is the most welcoming to converts, and he is the most, his most positive assessment of the, not just converts, proselytes, but of the process of trying to encourage people to become closer to God and, in effect, to convert to Judaism. This is all by way of a little introduction. So today, last week, we read the first paragraph of the Mishneh Torah, in which we see that the Rambam teaches us that the Torah has basic fundamental teachings. And of these, there's one that's most fundamental, and that is that God exists as one and is incorporeal. The Yesodi Yesodot, as we saw last week, the Avinu Chochmot, Leida, to know Sheyeshon, that there exists Matsui Rishon, a prime existent. I'm not going to repeat what we did last week. But the upshot of that is that anyone can know God. You don't need a Jewish soul to come close to God. You don't need a Jewish soul to know God. There are certain advantages to being Jewish because you have the Torah. The Torah sends you in that direction. But in principle, anyone can fulfill the first commandment of Judaism, obey the first commandment, the first of the Ten Commandments, etc. Today, I want to talk to you about the middle passage in the Mishnah Torah. And that's what we'll study in a minute. But first, a few words of background. As you know, the Mishnah Torah is divided into 14 volumes. Now, I wish I could have kind of a conversation with you, but that really does not work. The midpoint of the Mishnah Torah is therefore at the text that falls at the end of the seventh or the beginning of the eighth volume. Now, the seventh volume of the Mishnah Torah is called Sefer Zra'im, Book of Seeds, or more colloquially, the Book of Laws Concerning Agriculture. Of all 14 volumes in the Mishnah Torah, only one of them is divided into seven sections. That's the seventh volume, Sefer Zra'im, the Book of Agriculture. And the Book of Agriculture itself, as I said, is divided into seven sections. The seventh section of the seventh book is laws concerning the sabbatical year and the Jubilee. Hilchot Shmitah v'Yovel. Hilchot Shmitah v'Yovel, the laws concerning the sabbatical year and the Jubilee, is itself divided into 13 chapters. And the 13th chapter, in all the printed editions, in any event, it's not clear what Rambam had in mind, but we're going to go with all the printed editions. The 13th chapter has 13 paragraphs, 13 halachot. So the text we're about to read actually is the 13th of the 13th of the 7th of the 7th, or 7, 7, 13, 13, however you want to look at it. Now, we all know that 7 is a number that has a lot of significance in Judaism, starting off with 7 days and weeks, the creation of the universe, etc. We also know that for Rambam, at least, and not just, but certainly for Rambam, 13 is a number of great significance, especially in terms of his 13 principles of faith, which he had already written before he wrote the Mishnah Torah. So one might get the impression that I'm trying to tell you that there's great significance to the fact that the text we're about to read is the 7-7-13-13. And I don't think it could possibly be an accident. I also don't think it's at all important. Why do I think it's not all important? Because Rambam didn't play games like that. So my guess is that as he was coming close to this passage, he saw that he could play this little game. I don't think it has tremendous significance, but it'd be helpful if I could convince you that it had a lot of significance to Rambam, it would strengthen the point I want to make this morning, to me. But I don't want to mislead you. Rambam was not into gematria, tenuri, all these numerical games that Jews like to play. You don't find that in his writing. He was, I would say, too serious an individual. But despite all that, I think it's pretty neat that one of the most universalist texts ever written by any Jewish rabbi. You all know what Jewish rabbis are? My father, Olo Shalom, was a Jewish rabbi. He always thought it funny that people thought Jewish rabbis as opposed to, say, Episcopalian rabbis, Catholic rabbis. But name it, Rambam wrote, well, as a Jewish rabbi, wrote one of the most universalist texts that we find in any Jewish source, aside from the Torah, which is full of it. Okay, so now I'm going to hopefully share screen with you, and that'll be more or less the last time you see me till we get to the end of this session. So we press share screen, we push over here, we press share, and voila! Did it come up? Yes? Oh, thank you, Jay.
Yes.
I'm always amazed when it works. Okay, so I brought this text actually both in Hebrew and in English. I'll read it quickly in Hebrew and then in English, and we'll talk about it. Okay, so this is Hilchot Shmitah V'Yovel, Perek Yud Gimel, and the last two of Halachot Yud Bet or Yud Gimel. And remember, this is the seventh section of Sefer Zra'im, which in turn is the seventh book of the Mishnah Torah, which means this is at the very end of the seventh book of the 7 of 14. So it's really the midpoint of the entire work. Balama, I'm just going to read it fast for those of you who enjoy the Hebrew, even in my accent. Balama lo zacha Levi b'nachlat Eretz Yisrael b'mitzvata imacha echav. We'll do the Hebrew and English. Why was the tribe of Levi granted no right to a share in the land of Israel and spoils together with his brothers? Because they were set apart to worship the Lord, to serve him, and to teach his upright ways. Let's go on with the English. and his righteous judgments to the many, as it is said, they shall teach Jacob by an ordinance and Israel thy law. In other words, the Levium were set aside to be teachers of Torah. And that's why they were supposed to get their salary from the rest of the Jewish people through Masrut, through the tithe. The Levites, were consequently set apart from the ways of the world. That is the need to make a living. They may not wage war as do the rest of Israel. They have no share in the land, which is, of course, a source of income, and they may acquire nothing for themselves by physical force. They are rather the host of the holy name, as it is said, bless the Lord, his host. Okay? But host here, it means, you know, an army. Like the Hebrew appears, Barech Hashem Chelo. Chel is army. Okay? Got a joke about that I can't tell you. It is he, blessed be he, who acquires for them. As it is said, and the Lord spoke to Aaron, that shall have no inheritance the land, neither shalt thou have any part among them. I am thy portion and thine inheritance among the children of Israel. As you see here, that part of this pasuk verse is put in square brackets, because the Rambam, like every other medieval figure, would quote from the Torah the parts of the psukim they needed. And people like me add the rest of the pasuk in square brackets so you can see the whole context. Not too terribly important. Now we get to the very last paragraph in the 7th and 13th chapter of the 13th paragraph of the 13th chapter of the 7th section of the 7th book. Not only the tribe of Levi, but each and every individual of those who come into the world. The Hebrew there is kol ba'e olam. Up here somewhere. Yeah. Ella call ish we call by Ella right here. Make that yellow for you there. Starting again, but not only the tribe of Levi, but each and every individual of those who come into the world called by Ella. This literally means all those who come into the world whose spirit moves him. Rama meant to say whose spirit moves him and her, but he got lazy. And whose knowledge gives him or her understanding to set himself apart in order to stand before the Lord, to serve him, to worship, and to know him, who walks upright as God created him. We'll come back to this phrase in a moment. To do, and releases himself from the yoke of the many foolish considerations which trouble people. He focuses on important things. Such an individual is as consecrated as the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh Kodeshim, and his portion and inheritance shall be in the Lord forever and evermore. Lord will grant him in this world whatsoever is sufficient for him, the same as he had granted to the priests and the Levites. Thus indeed did David, upon whom be peace, say, O Lord, the portion of my inheritance is my cup. Thou, you God, maintainest, take care of my income, my lot. Okay, so now we have to ask, who is Rambam referring to here? Who are the called by Olam? Now, the literal meaning is all human beings. And that's the way the term is used almost in every place where it appears in rabbinic literature. However, those of you who have contact with the yeshiva world will find that this passage is often quoted. I bring you here a quotation from Mishnat Rabbi Aaron, a book of essays that were put together by his students of Rabbi Aaron Kotler. Rav Aaron was the founder of Beis Medrash Gevurah, the BMG, the Beis Medrash Gevurah, the Likud Yeshiva. And he is not alone, but he very clearly made the following statement about the Rambam here. He asks, who are these Ba'ei Olam who don't have to work for a living? Okay? And he says, Rabbi Aaron Kotler says, these are most assuredly, the hem, he's emphasizing it, the Torah scholars of the generation who are exclusively devoted to Torah. Because from the day that the temple was destroyed, the Holy One, blessed be, has nothing in his world but the four cubits of halakha, and that is in place of the temple service, and to tending the needs of the temple, which had been done by the Levites. Rabbi Aaron Kotler is using the Rambam here to say every single person listening to this lecture tonight should be sending money to a yeshiva. Now, is he right? Is that what the Rambam was talking about? Well, there are a large number of reasons to think that he isn't right. But I want to explain why he probably thought he was right. First of all, he probably thought he was right because it's clearly what his world thinks, that Kollel is the highest. And this is, by the way, just 100 years old in Judaism. Let's leave that aside. But the highest thing to which a Jewish male can aspire is to learn Kollel, and the highest thing which a Jewish female can aspire is to support her husband or her children for learning in Kollel. Now, why did, let's give Reb Aaron the benefit of the doubt. Why did he think that when Rambam says called by Olam, he actually means Jews? And of which Jews? Levim. But which Levim? The Rambam starts at the beginning of the paragraph. Not only the tribe of Levi, but who else? But who else could it be? Well, Reb Aaron Kotler is sure that these people who Rambam is talking about here are those that, again, the Torah scholars of the generation were exclusively devoted to Torah. Now, before I get into this, I just want to say one more thing back up here. You see where I put this this phrase in English, who walks upright as God created him? Now, it strikes me that Rambam may have taken advantage of what he's writing here to insert a tiny bit of anti-Christian polemic. Because he was aware of the notion fundamental to at least post-Augustinian Christianity of original sin. Now, a Christian who holds by that could not possibly say human beings walk upright as God created them. Because at least since the sin of Adam and Eve, none of us walk upright as God created them, because we are all stained by the sin of the original sin of Adam and Eve.
Yes, but Adam and Eve were created that way.
Sure, but we're not talking about everybody else. To serve anybody who walks upright as God created him. I think the Rambam is hinting here. I can't tell you for sure that I'm right. But it makes sense to me that he would certainly didn't believe in the Christian doctrine of original sin. Unlike other medieval figures who actually did accept it, but Rambam certainly did not. We're not going to get into that tonight. I think that may be what he's doing here. In any event, I want to continue giving, I want to give Reb Aaron a certain amount of credit, and then I'm going to say why he was wrong anyway. Aside from which fact that, I'm not going to get into the text here, but this, the passage here from Brachot, Chet Amad Aleph, 8a, is used by the Rambam in a very different fashion, but that's too complicated to get into here. And why did he think Kol Bei Olam means Jews? Some of you are familiar with this expression. Say yes.
Yes,
I'll tell
yes.
You where you're familiar with it from.
Yes.
This is the, I mean, the High Holy Days. If I were a different kind of person, I would sing this to you, but Yehudim Heim Rachmanim B'nei Rachmanim, and I'm well known for not being such a great singer. So this is a very famous piyut to him, which we recite in the Yamim Noraim, the High Holy Days. Unitara toke kudushat hayom, gihun orav hayom, ubot tinosei malchutecha v'ikon b'chesed kisecha, v'teshev alav v'emet, emet ki atahu dayan v'mochiach v'yodeh v'ed, v'kotev v'kotev v'sofer u'moneh, v'tizkor kol anish kachot, v'tiftach et sefer zikornot, v'elav yikarei v'kotam yad kol adapo, v'shofar gero yitaka, and here's the part where we have our expression again. And all those who come into the world will pass before you. That's it. Lots of what that expression means. It could be just sheep passing before the shepherd, which makes sense in the context of the following line, ki vakarat roe dro, as a shepherd brings his flocks to pasture, ma'avir tzono takat shifto, and and has the sheep or goats pass beneath his rod, his, whatever the shaven does in English, his staff. Kain tavir, so will you cause to pass, v'tispor, and count, v'timen, count again, v'tifkod, and pay attention to nefesh kol chai, the soul of every living being, v'tachtoch kitzva l'chol b'riyah, and you will determine the end of each created thing, v'tiktov et zardinam, and write down their fate. Now, when I gave a lecture about this text in our shul a couple of years ago, and claimed that what Rambam was talking about here is all human beings, so a very learned man in the shul, John Rabin, said, no, that can't be. Because Kol Bei Olam obviously means Jews. And I said, how do you know? He says, because it's in the Tana Tokef, the piyut I just read to you. So luckily, I said, okay, I don't have the text with me, but next time you ask me to speak in shul, I'll prove to you you're wrong. Which I'm about to do, to prove to you that my friend from shul and, in effect, your Baron Kotler Zatzal, we're both wrong. How do we know this? Because this Natana Tokim is clearly based upon the following Mishnah from Tractate Rosh Hashanah, the first chapter of the second Mishnah. Four transitional periods, the world is judged. The Pesach HaLatuah, Pesach for in terms of the grain, Batseret HaPerot HaIlan, the Rosh Hashanah, Kol ba'ei ha'olam uvrin lefanav kibnei maron. The Piyut actually quotes this verse from the Mishnah. And then he goes on to quote a verse from Tehillim. Shne'amar ha'yotzer yachad libam ha'mevin et kol ma'aseihem. B'chag in Sukkot nidonin alamayim. Okay, so we have here the Kol ba'ei ha'olam from Natana Tokev is based upon clearly. I mean, it's a quote. It's quoting this Mishnah. And the Mishnah cites Psalms 33, Tehillim, Daven Gimel. And I have here a few psukim from that Tehillah. You can look it up, the whole thing at home, believe I yod, without trouble. Mishamayim yibit Hashem, v'rad kol b'nei adam. God looks from heaven and sees all human beings. Mimachon shivto, from the place of his dwelling, so to speak, hishkiach El kol yoshvei ha'aretz, pays attention to all inhabitants of the world. Hayotzer yachad libam, he God who created their heart, ha'mevin el kol ma'aseihem, understands all that they're doing. So the Mishnah is quoting a pasuk in Tehillim, and Natana Tokev is clearly is explicitly quoting this Mishnah. All three of them refer to the fact that God judges all human beings, or in fact, perhaps if you want to say it that way, all creatures on Rosh Hashanah. So we can't use, even though most of you who are aware of the expression called by Olam, probably think, most of you probably thought, like my friend from Shul, that it came from, that it talks about human Jews, because Jews are the object of the prayers of Rosh Hashanah. Okay. So clearly Kol Bei Olam does not necessarily mean only Jews, and it certainly does not mean only Talmidei Chachamim, who therefore expect to be supported by the rest of the Jewish community. Before I go on with this, just getting back to our point, we see here an important text for the purposes of our session tonight. Going back here. Let me just read it again. Not only the tribe of Levi, but each and every individual of those who come into the world, whose spirit moves them, whose knowledge gives them understanding to set himself apart in order to save before the Lord, to serve him, to worship and to know him, who walks upright as God created him to do and releases himself from the yoke of many foolish considerations which trouble people. Such an individual is as consecrated as the Holy of Holies. And God will be his support and his take care of his service. So obviously Rambam doesn't think too many, I shouldn't say obviously, but I'm claiming Rambam does not think too many people, Jews or Gentiles, can become Kodesh Kodeshim. But he certainly didn't think it was something that was unique to Jews. It was called Ba'ei Olam can aspire to this. Let me make a parenthetical remark here about aspiration. The important thing to understand about the Rambam is that he did not think that we get anything given to us on a silver platter. Not our humanity, not our Jewish identity. Everything we accomplish, we accomplish because we worked at it. And Judaism is all about aspiration, not about presents, not about gifts. God expects us to do things. God expects us to accomplish things. God expects us to improve ourselves. God doesn't give us like anything in particular. That's why one of the many reasons Rambam would not like the idea that Jews are in some inherent, intrinsic, inborn sense superior to other human beings, because that means that God gave the Jews a present that nobody else got. And nobody gets presents. Everybody's given an opportunity to earn things. And there are a lot of things Rambam says which I think are more Aristotle than Torah, but this I think is very much in the tradition of Judaism as we know it, that we are given opportunities to earn things, and including our humanity, including our basic Jewishness. So all that fits together very well with his, what he said here in this paragraph from Hilchot Shmita Yovel, and it's another reason why I think that Gagarin, not surprisingly, given the world he came from and the world he was creating, I think misunderstood the Rambam. Now, a further reason is because of the next point I want to make to you, is because the Rambam hated the idea of Kolel. He's very famous. He's notorious for that. And very few, even in the world of Kolel, people don't deny that. They try and ignore it or work around it or find excuses. One of the Rambam's, I wouldn't say followers, but somebody who wrote a parish in the Mishnah Torah thought highly of the Rambam. Baz, Ibn Zimra, was once asked about this, and he said, well, the Rambam came from a wealthy family. He didn't have to go work for a living. And that's why he could say that Talmidei Chachamim aren't allowed to earn money from their learning. Of course, it's not true. Rambam's younger brother died in an accident. His ship foundered and he's drowned in the Indian Ocean. Rambam went to work. He worked very hard, according to the descriptions we have in letters he sent. But in any event, what does he say? You can all look up his commentary in Mishnah 4:6. That's a long text, so I'm not going to talk to you about that. But he also sums up his view in his commentary on Mishnah Dinorim 4:3, and here I have that. I'm quoting again from the Rambam. And I wonder about great individuals who, blinded by greed, deny the truth and assign themselves stipends for ruling, sipsak, and studying, relying on flimsy evidence. Great individuals, Rabbanim Gdolim, Talmidei Chachamim, were blinded by greed. And they knew better, but despite that, they convinced themselves that it was all right to get paid for psika and for learning. And the Rambam continues, and we shall speak about this matter in its place in Treatise Avot. Here is what he says. That you have to look up yourself. It's a very, very long text. He's very annoyed there. But he also goes back to this in his text in the Mishnah Torah called Hilchot Talmud Torah, Laws Concerning the Study of the Torah, which is back in the first volume of the Mishnah Torah, Sefer Mandan. This is what Rambam says there. One, however, who makes up his mind to study Torah and not work, but live on charity, profanes the name of God, brings the Torah into contempt, extinguishes the light of religion, brings evil upon himself and deprives himself of life hereafter. For it is forbidden to derive any temporal advantage from the words of the Torah. The sages said, whoever derives a profit for himself from the words of the Torah is helping it on his own destruction. They have further charged us, make not of them a crown wherewith to aggrandize themselves, nor a spade wherewith to dig. They likewise exhorted us, love work, hate lordship. It's not Rabbanut. I'll study the Torah, not conjoin with work, all study of the Torah not conjoined with work must, in the end, be futile and become a cause of sin. The end of such a person will be that he will rob his fellow creatures. This is really not the issue I wanted to discuss with you tonight, but it's pretty clear to me that this proves that Rav Aharon Zatzal, the founder of the yeshiva in Lakewood, and almost everybody else in the yeshiva world, and many people in the non-yeshiva world, are very right to think that it is right and proper for Jewish people to support students in Kollel. But they don't have a right to claim Rambam for that. I think that's a big mistake on their part, and I think they should be more upfront to say Rambam disagrees with this. You know, he's allowed to be wrong. Of course, they have a problem with saying this. They can't say Rambam is allowed to be wrong. But in any event, that the main point here is that Rav Aharon's use of the Rambam here is made, among other things, an attempt to say that Menachem Kellner is wrong, and that the Kol Bayi Olam referenced here in this paragraph are not all human beings, Jews and Gentiles. They are rather only Jews, and among Jews, only Talmidei Chachamim, who study all the time. So if I've convinced you at all, then you'll see that that middle paragraph, which I've told you is emphasized in all kinds of interesting ways, is a further expression of Rambam's overall view that Jews have special obligations but no special benefits. No special inborn, inherent, upfront benefits. Of course, learning Torah and keeping the mitzvot is good for you. Very good for you. Okay. Let me just take a drink here for a second. Now, if it weren't for the fact that I have to cancel next week's session, I would have spent a lot more time, would have wrote more texts to show you that the way I'm interpreting Rambam here is actually the way the Rambam is interpreting himself. Of that I am quite convinced. That I'm convinced doesn't make it right, but I think it is. Now I want to jump to the very end of the Mishneh Torah, the 14th volume. That volume is called Sefer Shoftim, the Book of Judges, and it's largely about civil law. The last section of Sefer Shoftim, which is the last section of the Mishneh Torah, is called Hilchot Melachim or Milchamoteyem, Laws of Kings and Their Wars. And that section has 12 chapters. We're going to look at the last paragraph in that in a few minutes. The first many words of introduction. Of the 12 chapters in Laws of Kings and Their Wars, the last two chapters, 11 and 12, deal with a particular king, namely Melech HaMashiach, the Messianic king. Now, Rambam could have put his discussion of the Messiah in many other places in the Mishneh Torah. He brings it up briefly in Hilchot Tshuva, Laws of Repentance. He has a whole section called Hilchot Beit HaPtira, Laws Concerning the Temple. It would make sense to talk about the Messiah there because the temple will only be rebuilt in the days of the Messiah, the days of the Mashiach. But he chooses to end the Mishneh Torah with these two chapters. And he puts the chapters concerning the Messianic king in the context of a discussion of normal kings. I.e., in effect, what Rambam seems to be doing here is indicating to us that the Messianic era is normal. Melech HaMashiach, the Messianic king, is another king in a long line of kings. And he says this explicitly, I'm not there, that, and this is important for a lot of reasons, that the coming of the Messiah is something we cannot know until it actually has succeeded. In other words, there might be a king, a kosher king, descended from David, who fulfills the Torah, and tries to do what the Mashiach is meant to do. And we will not know if this king is the Mashiach or not until he succeeds. If he fails, dies, or is killed, then all we can say is that he was a well-intentioned king of the house of David who sought to become the Messiah and failed. In other words, you can't really know if a king is the Messiah until looking back. The proof of the messianic pudding is in the eating thereof. This is another way of indicating that this whole process takes place within what we would call normal history. That's another important point. Rambam emphasizes over and over again that Bimot HaMashiach in the Messianic era, the world as we know it continues. Olam kiminago noheg. It's not as if comes the I used to remember making fun of people, comes the revolution. Rambam didn't think that comes the Mashiach, cholesterol-free parva steaks will grow on trees. You can see what interests me. He thought that after the coming of the Mashiach, we're going to need plumbers. We're going to need electricians. There'll be learned plumbers and learned electricians. But if we need plumbers, it means we have sewage. We're going to need... The world goes on. It's normal history. And he tells us that when the Sefer Yeshayahu, for example, or other, when you talk about the miraculous nature of the Messianic era, they're speaking metaphorically. You know, the Pasuk says, Vigarz Avim Kemis. The wolf will lie down with the lamb, right? Now, there's not a problem as long as you have a steady and large supply of lambs. Rambam tells us explicitly that the pasuk, the wolf lies that will lie down with the lamb, the garzev and kevis, is not talking about a change in nature. It's talking about the fact that the nations of the world who are today treat us as wolves treat lambs will dwell with us in peace and harmony. That's one very important thing to understand about the Messianic era. There are no miracles, no special effects. George Lucas, Steven Spielberg need to look for work elsewhere. They are not involved in the coming of the Mashiach. Another important point to realize, that we should know this because we just learned, that means I just told you, that you can't know in advance if a Mashiach is, if a fugitive Mashiach is indeed the Mashiach, is that the upshot of Rambam's discussion in these two chapters is that the coming of the Mashiach is a process. It's not an event. Many years ago, I remember reading with great interest and enjoyment two books of collected Hasidic tales by Martin Buber. I think it was called actually Tales of the Hasidim. I don't remember anymore. He tells the story of a Hasidic Rebbe in Yerushalayim who hears tumult on the streets outside. So he goes to the porch, says, what's going on? And somebody yells, the Mashiach has come. So he sniffs the air. Says, no, the Mashiach hasn't come. Now, I never understood that story because it was meant to be told in Yerushalayim, which, well, back in those days, had very clear air. Now, if the story were told in Haifa with its pollution, and I can understand if the rabbi sniffs and smells fresh air, then Mashiach has indeed come. But that's simply an expression of the idea that the coming of the Mashiach is an event, not a process. Rambam makes it very clear that the coming of the Mashiach is an event. Beyond that, he says something which was so unusual as to create an uproar in the sense that these passages were censored from the text of the Mishnah Torah, and we don't know by whom. Could have been by Christians, by Muslims, or even by Jews. As Rambam makes the following point, we don't know what God's plans are. And so, this is not totally relevant, but the sort of Jew who doesn't agree with Rambam, God, and me, is described in the following joke. there's a Jew from Kiev, okay? Talking about the Ukraine these days, who goes to visit his cousin in a little shtetl. And he asked the Jew from the shtetl, he asked his cousin, how many people live in your shtetl? And the guy says, about 2,000. How many of these are Jews? About 1,800. Then the Jew from the shtetl says, and how many people live in Kiev? With great pride, the guy from Kiev says, about 3 million. Really? And how many of them are Jewish? Maybe 200,000. So the guy from the shtetl looks at him in amazement and says, really? Why do you need so many goyim? Now, there's a guy here named Chaim Malks, whom I love. He laughs at all these dumb jokes of mine. And Jay is not too bad also with laughing at the jokes. In any event, Rambam in effect asks, what role did Christianity and Islam play in the coming of the Messiah? And he says they have a role. They contribute to the monotheization of the world. Since the coming of the Mashiach is a process without miracles, and yet at the end of that process, the whole world will accept the truth of the Torah, then how does that come about? Convert everybody from polytheism or paganism to Judaism overnight is a miracle of greater proportions than anything that Moshe Rabbeinu ever did. So Rambam says that's the point of Christianity and Islam. They prepare the world for the notion of one God, for the notion of mitzvot, and that's their role. They are, in effect, harbingers of the Messiah. So this is another way in which we can see Rambam really held that becoming the Messiah, the process, it's a process, not an event. Okay, we're getting close to the point where I can teach you the last paragraph of his discussion of the Messiah, which is also the last paragraph of his entire Mishnah Torah. I have to make two more preliminary comments. The first is, throughout his writings, Rambam clearly teaches that human perfection is a goal that could be achieved by all human beings. And the height of human perfection consists of first perfecting yourself morally, because immoral people cannot be intellectually perfected. Rambam, like every other medieval, was convinced, following Plato, that that virtue is knowledge that an unvirtuous person couldn't really know, could not really be an intellectual. We know, unfortunately, it's not true, but he was convinced of that. So therefore, in order to achieve the highest level of human perfection, which for him was knowing the greatest amount of truth that you could possibly know, in order to achieve that, you have to be a very good person. And that's, by the way, why for him, Jews have an advantage over Gentiles, because the Jews have the Torah, which, if followed properly, will contribute towards making you a better person and making society a better society. So Jews certainly have an advantage, but it's not inborn or inherent or metaphysical or whatever like that. In any event, since we know, Rambam says over and over again that the highest level of intellectual, of highest level of human perfection is understanding the truth. This follows from his acceptance of the idea that human beings are rational animals. We are animals in the same way in which monkeys and pigs and elephants are animals. But what distinguishes us from those other animals is Homo sapiens, the sapiens part, the thinking part. So if in the Yemot HaMashiach the whole world will accept the Torah, we have to assume that the whole world has achieved a certain level of that kind of perfection, which again is an indication of why we need the Christians and the Muslims to help prepare the world for that, to get people in the direction of fulfilling at least a certain number of mitzvot, becoming better people, more moral, and then perhaps being able to continue on the road to intellectual perfection. Okay, that was the first point I want to make at this juncture. And the second point has to do with a story which may or may not be true. I once spent a lot of time on the internet trying to find out if it was true, and I found a lot of sources saying it was true, and a lot of other sources saying it was an urban legend. Either way, this is what is claimed. It is claimed that the first time the plays of William Shakespeare were translated into Yiddish on the title page of the book, it said, I can't say this in Yiddish, all the plays of William Shakespeare are teiched und verbessert, translated and improved. Okay? That in Israel, in my generation, not my students, have no idea what I'm talking about. The expression of verteicht and verbessert, translated and improved, is taken, you know, when you take somebody else's idea and monkey around with it. You've translated it and improved it. In any event, before the invention of print, texts were passed on by copyists. You know, for example, Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah, right? And we know that people would come to his house and physically sit there for a while. I assume that Mrs. Rambam gave them tea and cookies, and they would copy the Mishnah Torah. And there were people who did this for like a profession. You've all seen movies of medieval monasteries where there are a dozen or 15 or 20 younger monks sitting in front of tables writing while an older monk dictates to them what they're supposed to copy down. That's like, that's the industrialization of this process. Instead of one person copying, you got 20 people copying. And we know that this, we all know this for a fact. The process of trying to copy a text is always involves mistakes. And that's why people like me, when we deal with medieval texts, have to go to a great deal of effort to find out what the author actually wrote. And there's a whole technique, critical scholarship, of trying to comparing manuscripts, judging which manuscripts are the better ones and why they're the better ones, and trying to figure out which is the text closest to what the author himself, himself wrote. But despite the best efforts, lots and lots of mistakes have entered. And what we find in case of the Rambam is that there are simply lots of cases of what I call verteichen and verbessern, where people improve what he wrote. Now, consistently, these so-called improvements take the writings of the Rambam in a direction, in a more particularist direction than they would be without those improvements. If any of you are interested, I can send you articles in Hebrew with many examples of this. It's one of my hobbies to find places where, over the generations, what Rambam actually wrote was changed to make it sound more forfront or more normal from the perspective of your standard Jews. And one of the most dramatic places of that is in the very last. Well, some of you know this. If you know this phenomenon, you know the mission in Sanhedrin. Anyone who destroys a Jewish soul, as if he destroyed the whole world. Familiar to you? Well, the word Jewish there was added afterwards. The Mishnah text actually says, Kol HaMabed Nefesh Achat, anyone who destroys a human being, Kilo Ibeid Olam Malay. But you will find it with the extra word Yisrael all over the place. Almost every printed text of the Mishnah has it. But a variety of scholars have proven beyond my doubting anyway. I even found the correct text in the Quran of all places, quoting the Jews in any event. So consistently, the changes introduced into the Rambam's text make him sound more forfront, more dusty, more dati, more typically Jewish religious. And I want to make an important point. I do not for a moment think that people who made those corrections in scare quotes, were doing it on purpose. No one would have the chutzpah to say, well, the Rambam wrote this, but he was wrong, so I'll fix it. That's only in our generation. People amend the text of the Torah, right? Al dat atzmam, on their own authority. I'm sure that these so-called corrections were either done inadvertently, not on purpose, or because the person making the change was convinced that clearly the text as it stands in front of me is mistaken. It can't have been this way. And we have now before us a classic example of this phenomenon. Here we have the last paragraph of the 12th chapter of the laws of Kings, the last paragraph of the two chapter discussion of the Messiah, and the very last paragraph in the Mishneh Torah. We're finally getting to that. We've studied the first paragraph, the middle paragraph, and now we're going to read the last paragraph. And he's talking about when the Messianic era has reached fruition. Uvoto hazman, at that time, lo yesham. Remember we spoke up last week about Sheyesham being there exists. It's an Arabism in the Rambam's Hebrew. It's the same thing here. Uvotozman, at that period, the end of the Messianic era, when it reaches completion, lo yesham, they will not exist. Lo ra'av, not hunger. Lo milchama, not war. Lo kina, no jealousy. I never thought of this before. Takharut in modern Hebrew is competition. So I guess you could say that Rambam is not a Republican. Just parenthetically, I have no idea if he would support the Democrats or the Republicans. If he asked me, I would know what to tell him. And it would not be Republican. But in any event, that's just to be... I have no idea what... But forget that. Okay. I'll go back again. At that time, lo yesham, they will not exist, neither hunger, nor war, nor jealousy, nor competition. Why not? Not because it's a change in nature, or even in human nature. Good things will be freely available. Shefa. B'chol ha'madanim, and they're all delicacies. You guys are mostly in Toronto. In New York, stores that sell kosher or kosher-style delicacies are called delicatessens, right? Say yes. Anyway, in Hebrew, modern Hebrew, in Israel, Hebrew, they're called madaniot. So all of the delicacies will be found like dust. Now, I want to interrupt for a moment and say, I don't believe for a second that Rambam thinks that in the Messianic era, the world, we know the nature is not going to change. So how can he say that there will be all these things? Well, once again, I think the Rambam's, this is, you know, maybe unfair interpreting this way. He's basically teaching us that if we would take what we need instead of what we want, it would be enough for everybody. And that's true today also. There's no reason why anybody in the world today has to die of hunger or live in poverty. There's enough wealth to go around for everybody. And if we are all as smart as we should be and will be in the Messianic era, then everybody will have enough. Now he goes on to the part that's important for our purposes. V'lo ye'esek kol ha'olam. And the business of the whole world will be nothing other than l'dat et Hashem bilvad, only to know God. Remember, kol ha'olam. And then he continues, Lefichach, therefore, ye you, I'm skipping the word in yellow, Chachamim Gdolim, there will be great wise people. Yodim Dvarim Stumim Hamukim, and they'll know things, deep and hidden things. Yasigu Dad Boram, and they will achieve the knowledge of their creator. Kifi Koach Ha'adam, the greatest human extent possible. Shene'amar, because the land will be full of the knowledge of God, kamayim layam mechasim, in the same way that water covers the seabed. Oh. You guys know Rabbi Korobkin in Toronto? Some of you must know him. The Rabbi of Beit? No? All right. I learned from him to realize that Yam does not mean sea, it means seabed. Whatever. Good man. So the way I read this text, which is the way Rambam wrote it, and that we can easily prove, says as follows. V'lo ye'esek kol olam, and the business or occupation of the whole world will only be to know God. And therefore, there will be great wise people who know things which are now hidden and deep and hidden, and they will achieve the knowledge of their creator to the extent as much as humanly possible, etc. Now, somebody in the Middle Ages saw this text, said, obviously a word dropped out. Rambam couldn't be talking about, couldn't really actually mean kol olam, the whole world. Therefore, they inserted this word, Yisrael. And therefore, Jews will be chachamim gdolim, v'yodim dvarim astumim ha'amukim, etc. Now, it's not impossible, that's what the Rambam wrote. He didn't, but it's not impossible. But this is such a clear indication of how someone came along and read a text by the Rambam, which really did teach what he meant it to teach, namely that in the Messianic era, all human beings would be wise and know God to the extent that is humanly possible. Now, what does humanly possible mean? Will we all be Einsteins? No. But each of us will maximize his or her human potential. Kefi koach adam doesn't mean according to the strength of humanity, but rather of human beings. So the Messianic era will be an era of very smart and very learned plumbers and electricians, etc., as well as college professors. By the way, a person like me is a big fan of Rambam's Messianic teaching, because since he holds the whole world want to study Judaism, people like me will be in great demand to teach it. So it's another reason to be in favor of the Rambam. Okay, I'm supposed to end in 4 minutes. Let me just summarize what we've been doing here with these two sessions. I've tried to indicate to you that when somebody like Menachem Kellner tells you that according to Rambam, when the Torah says that all human beings are created in the image of God, the Torah means it. And that anybody who comes and tells you, be it Yehuda Levi or the authors of the Zohar, or most medieval Jewish rabbis, as opposed to Episcopalian rabbis, or most almost every Orthodox rabbi today, if they come and tell you that that's not exactly right, that the Jews are in some significant sense innately, inherently, upfrontly superior to Gentiles, that they are right to that view. That view is not without sources, but they should not take Rambam as a authority for that view, because he clearly did not hold that view. Okay. So I'm going to stop sharing here so we can see each other. No idea what iPad 6 Vina means, but it must be somebody's thing.
Rabbi Dr. Kellner, can you explain what Rambam means at the very end there, where he's saying, Esek ha'olam will be ledat Hashem lefichach. It sounds like he's saying people will only be studying and won't be working.
Why?
So then stakes will be growing on trees.
No, ma'am. No. As much as I like the idea, I can have a steak, and also the steak growing on trees will be part of. Ice cream. But no, he told us explicitly that the world continues in its alam kaminago noeg. There are no changes in the order of nature. But instead of wasting our times on TV, on movies, on wars, on competition for resources that shouldn't be scarce, we'll spend our time in more important issues. We'll work for a living. Some of us will be plumbers. Some of us will be electricians. Some of us will be college professors. Some of us will be stockbrokers. I don't know about that. But in any event, we'll all work for a living. But we'll be interested in working for a living so that we can have time to improve ourselves. And also, here I'm adding, because he doesn't say, he does say it actually. Working is itself a good thing. So we're not reliant upon charity.
I was just questioning his use of the word asek, which sounds like there will be no asek ella. The only thing they'll be doing is.
But asek is, you're thinking in modern Hebrew where asek is business. In this case, it's anything that people do, litasek. There will be no no, I don't know, functions. Nobody will be busy with anything except to improve themselves.
It just sounds like that's all they're doing, sitting in kollel.
But remember, even sitting in an academic library or in a laboratory or fixing somebody's sewage.
Are you ready for a question from your cousin?
Hi there, how are you?
Okay, good to see you. But as usual, I have questions. The Rambam, as you cast him, is a universalist.
Yes.
And as we look through most of the Torah and through the Talmud for sure, we find that this religion seems to be a tribal religion.
It is.
And we are distinguished from the non-Jews. The Havdalah is ingrained within the system. Even when we are not the same. We are the chosen people. I know you can say that we're chosen for a purpose, but clearly there's us and there's them. And the way you describe the Rambam right now, it's a universalism. There's one God who has rules for everyone. I don't get that from either Torah or Talmud or even the Rambam in his Book of Laws.
Well, I certainly didn't say it, and nor did I mean to imply it, but it's a very, very important question because it's easy to get this one to be confused about it. Rambam is a universalist in exactly one sense. That is that all human beings are created in the image of God and that no subset of humanity, i.e. the Jews, is innately or inherently superior to other subsets. Let me give you a kind of silly example. Some of the people listening to this class are living in Toronto, Canada. Most of them, unlike you and I, could not be elected president of the United States because they weren't born in America. I don't expect that either one of us is going to become president of the United States, nor would I wish it upon my cousin. But there are differences, but these differences are statutory. They're legal. They're not innate or inherent. And the very fact that anybody can become a Jew means the difference is not something that's, we could call it ontological or inherent or metaphysical. It's a difference of law, of status. Let me try and give you another couple of examples to make the point clearer. There is a clear-cut law which says if you're walking down the street and you see a hot dog on the street, and there are five butcher shops on that corner, four are kosher and one is not. The halacha is clear. That hot dog is kosher. No matter, you could have subjected to DNA tests and discover that it comes from a pig. It doesn't matter. Until you do that DNA test, that hot dog is kosher. Because kashrus is not a matter that's of something that's essential. It's the way the law defines what kosher is. Well, Jews are different from Gentiles because there are different laws obtained with Jews, different laws obtained with Gentiles. Different obligations are on Jews. Different obligations are on Gentiles. Jews are definitely the apple of God's eye, so to speak. For sure. There's no doubt about that. But the question is that because the Jews are in some sense special, or is it because they are chosen and they have the Torah? Let me put it to you like this. Rambam thinks that the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob became the Jews by virtue of getting the Torah. Became Israel, the people of Israel. Yudah Levi thinks that the Jews received the Torah because they were upfront antecedently superior, that there's something innate difference there. So much so that Alevi is a very honest man. He says, of course we have laws involving conversion, but a person who converts to Judaism is not as Jewish as someone who was born that way. There's I don't want to use the word defect, but there is a difference. The difference is not practical. The difference is in the fact that a born Jew can aspire to prophecy, and a converted Jew cannot. will never be able, and only if convert descendants after several generations, if they marry born Jews, will in effect, no genetics, right? Will in effect be absorbed into the Jewish people? Rambam thinks that's total nonsense. The halacha is, as he puts it in the Mishnah Torah, and as if is the halacha, that a person who converts to Judaism comes out of the mikveh, Yisrael l'chol dvaro, a Jew in every possible respect. So the moment, now, Zohar, for example, has the same problem that Olivia has. One of the answers the Zohar gives is in effect to say there's no such thing as conversion. A person who converts to Judaism is a person who had a Jewish soul already. And by accident, some sort of clerical error on high, it fell into the body of a Gentile. And it's that this Jewish soul which makes the person want to convert. But then in effect says there's no conversion here. This person was always Jewish. But a person who has a Gentile soul can never become Jewish. And many Chabadnikim today have another answer. They say, true, a person with a Gentile soul is different from and inferior to a person with a Jewish soul. So how do you account for the fact that that halacha allows for conversions? Well, if a person sincerely converts, God performs a miracle and changes the nature of that person's soul. And it's not the sort of miracle Rambam would look upon with joy. If you write to me, I'll send you lots and lots of articles and stuff on the subject, but that's the basic point. Somebody just asked an interesting question. Aren't Kohanim innately different? Someone I see named Kohen. Wonder why they asked that question. No, Kohanim are not innately different, but they have different roles, different obligations, and different benefits. That does not make them innately different. It means that they, the laws treat Kohanim differently than it treats the rest of us. Not because Kohanim are in any way better than other Jews. They have different status.
Can I ask a follow-up question to your comment on the hot dog, whether it's kosher or not? As you provided the example of, you have four butcher shops that are kosher and one that's not. And you pointed out, you know, with regard to DNA, if you have a DNA that can determine whether it's kosher or not, the DNA is irrelevant because the law is that it depends on the majority. Well, my question to you basically is, to me, it would seem logical that you have the rule of majority where you have no other ability to identify the certainty of the hot dog, and therefore you go with probability. But that, I mean, there was no DNA in those times. And so therefore, if you have the ability to determine that the hot dog is either kosher or not kosher, that you don't have to get involved in a rule that is necessary without the DNA to make
some. You're 100% right, and I didn't make it clear enough. Obviously, if we could find out if this hot dog is treif, then it's treif because it satisfies the criteria of what tarpus is. But the point of that example is that halacha, the expression is batar rov. It goes after the, as you put it, probabilities. The very fact that that's the way, you know, you could have, if you thought that something being treif was innate to nature, then you would never touch that hot dog because it might possibly be treif. That's an important point in contemporary Judaism. Right. Most Orthodox Jews today think that halacha reflects antecedent ontological realities and that therefore they have a problem with this halacha. But in general, something is treif because it's by nature, by the way in which the world works, it's treif. Something which is tamei, ritually impure, is an objective feature of the universe. That's the view of most Jews you know, certainly ones with kippot on their heads. That is not the view of the Rambam. It's certainly not the view of all of Chazal.
The hot dog situation is more complicated because if you go into one of those stores and buy a hot dog and come out, and you don't remember which one you went to, you can't eat it.
Right.
Even though four of the five are kosher.
There are a lot of complications to everything. This is a Jewish text, so obviously there are lots of complications. But the point remains. Let me try and give you another example to illustrate this point. There are certain kinds of violations which cause you to be obligated to bring a sacrifice called the Korban Shgagah. Now, Ramban, Nachmanides, asks, why do you have to bring a Korban Shgagah? You made a mistake. Why do you have to, in some sense, repair that mistake by bringing a sacrifice? And he answers, because if a Jew violates a mitzvah, a commandment, that in some real sense stains that person's soul. And the only way to clean the stain off the soul is by what we would call in modern terms a kind of magical act. You bring a sacrifice, and that sacrifice fixes the problem in your soul. Now, Rambam also says clearly that there are many violations of halakha which generate the obligation to bring a korban shgagah. And so he says, why? After all, just like Rambam asks, it was just a mistake. And Rambam says, the reason is that you should have made the mistake. You should have been more careful. And if you have to bring an expensive korban because you made that mistake, you'll be more careful next time. It's the same way if any of you drive 100 miles an hour, 100 kilometers an hour on a highway way over the speed limit, and you get stopped by a cop and write out a ticket for several hundred whatever isms, shkalim here, dollars there, loonies in Canada, you might ask, what's the point of it? I apologize. I'll never do it again. Why have to pay all this money? Well, from our purposes, modern sense, the idea is it's a way to teach you a lesson, so you won't do it again. And that's Rambam's view about shkagah. But because Ramban, Nachmanides, thinks that the halakha reflects antecedent ontological realities in the universe, you know, here. You see the two things I'm holding up? Chapstick and a bottle of tea? Well, let's say this bottle is tamei, is ritually impure, and this chapstick is ritually pure. If I could develop a device like a tumamometer, like a Geiger counter, then when it went over the thing was which was tamei, it would go click, 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 click. When it goes over the thing which is tahor, it's silent. Because these are objective facets of reality. That's one view. It's not Rambam's view. Something is tahor because halacha says it's tahor. Something is tamei because something says it's tamei. So this all goes back to the earlier questions. There are no innate differences between Jews and Gentiles. Jews have certain obligations and benefits, and Gentiles have different obligations and different benefits. But in the final analysis, they're all created in the image of God, which is the point I've been trying to make all evening.
According to the Ramban, the way you're using the Korban Shgagah as an opportunity to learn from, that a person wouldn't make that mistake again.
Ramban. Let's stick to English translations. Nachmanides says you've stained your soul. Maimonides says you better not do it again. I'm going to give you a fine in order to make you.
Okay. Sorry, it's easier to say Ramban. So the Ramban
makes no sense.
Okay, but what I want to say, if you're supposed to learn, you're bringing Korban Shgagah because you're supposed to learn something from this and not make the same mistake again.
That's Maimonides.
That's Maimonides.
Yes.
So if, in fact, it's just plain and simple a mistake that you cannot learn from, that are you saying that you can never have such a thing? I'm judging by your facial expression that
I guess you can see it. I'm enough of an optimist to think that we can always learn something from everything. And I'm sure Rambam felt that way. Why not? What can you think of an example of where I made a mistake from which I can never learn anything to be more careful or to avoid it?
Oh, I don't know. Not off the top of my head, but I would tend to think that there are instances where even legally something is a mistake by which, yes, it was a mistake, but you really should never have done this. And we want to make sure that you'll never do it again. Okay. As distinguished from a situation where you made a mistake, but it's a one of and very unlikely that a mistake will be made again. And therefore, I guess my question is, if you accept that, doesn't sound like you accept it, but if you accept it, that would seem to imply that you wouldn't have to bring a Korban Shgagah.
You bring the Korban Shgagah, not for every little mistake. You know, right. You pick up a pencil on Shabbos, you don't bring Korban Shgagah.
Okay. Okay. All right. So that's my point.
Oh, but basically, you don't know the law. And the idea is you're supposed to learn the law.
Sometimes learning the law is more important than other times. But I don't think we're disagreeing about anything here. I'm trying to make a point about the different understandings of the nature of halakha. The view that halakha reflects antecedent ontological realities. Let me give you another and final example. I really got to go. Let's say a man and a woman have sexual relations in the morning. In the afternoon, she marries somebody else. And in the evening, the original couple have sexual relations again. Now in the morning, that doesn't carry with it much in the way of punishment. No, it's not something which the Jewish tradition admires, but there's no actual, just my knowledge, there's no clear-cut punishment in halakha. In the evening, the same two people do the same exact thing, and they're now both chayev skila. They both are punished by death. Now, did that woman's ontological nature change? No, her status changed. In the morning, she was unmarried. In the evening, this is already an act of adultery. In the morning, it was an act of, shall we say, free love or something. In the evening, it was adultery. So that's a good example, I think, to show you that halakha is a matter of definition, statutes, standings, not a matter of the way in which the world functions. Let me put to you another. I should really end with this. For Rambam, halakha could have been different. Why this? What I'm saying now is explicitly taught in the Guide of the Perplexed. Why is it forbidden to wear an article of clothing made of wool and linen together, shatnez? Rambam tells us, because in the time of Avraham Avinu and Moshe Rabbeinu, Kohanei Avodah Zarah, the priests of idolatry, specifically, dafka, wore robes made of wool and linen together. To keep the Jews far away from idolatry, the Torah forbade us to wear garments like that. But that's an historical contingent fact. If Kohanei Avodah Zarah, the priests of ancient idolatry, wore polyester, the Torah would have forbade polyester. But these are contingent historical facts which could have been different. Now, not every halakha could be different, but some can be, which means they don't reflect, they reflect historical realities, cultural realities, and do not reflect intrinsic, inherent, whatever realities. Look, let me just end here by telling everybody who's interested can write to me, and I can send you references to books and articles by me and others on all these subjects, if you want to like spend your time studying them. But what I've been able to spend with you in this hour and 20 minutes is just like the end points of a lot of discussion. And I want to emphasize, everything I've said tonight is, I'm convinced, true and an accurate depiction of what Rambam taught. But I can tell you an awful lot of smart Jewish people who would say I'm totally wrong. And that Rambam could not possibly have said the things I attribute to him, despite the fact he wrote that that's a separate issue. So that do not think that I'm not aware of the fact that what I'm offering here is an interpretation. Correct, but an interpretation of Rambam. Rambam wrote such that everything one says about him has to be an interpretation because he wrote for many audiences at the same time. And therefore, different audiences read him differently. Okay, I appreciate your interest. I wish everyone, for you, a good morning, for me, a good evening. And keep on supporting Torah in Motion. It's a nifty project. Sai Gesund. And you can write to me if you have questions. My email address is menachem.kellner, menachem.kellner, K-E-L-N-E-R, @gmail.com. Sai Gesund. Stay healthy. Avoid corona. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.